Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, presidents, prime ministers, and the Pope jet across an unruly world.
He's a strong leader who wants a free and democratic Iraq to succeed. The United States is determined to help him achieve that goal.
The Iraq government does not call it a civil war. Two, the Iraq government is functioning. Three, the Iraq security forces are responsive to the Iraqi government.
Police continue to trace possible witnesses and to examine Mr. Litvinenko's movements at relevant times.
May our encounter today serve as an impetus and joyful anticipation of the gift of full communion.
It sounds to me like excessive force was used, but that's up to the district attorney to find out.
At a summit in Jordan, President Bush stands by Nuri al-Maliki, but a leaked White House memo reveals doubts about the Iraqi leader. More denials this week there from General Peter Pace that Iraq is in a state of civil war. The Russian spy murder mystery deepens. Now thousands of air travelers find out they too may have been exposed to polonium-210. And calls for answers and charges of racism in the wake of a deadly New York police shooting. This week on Point, this hour on our news roundtable goes inside these stories and more. We've got a terrific panel with us today. Barbara Slavin of USA Today is still coming up the stairs, I hear. Karen Tumbley's with us from Washington. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, thanks for being there.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Karen.
Karen, jump in with us first on Iraq. From leaks in Washington to the summit in Amman, it really dominated the news, though there's a lot going on this week. Where do we stand on this problem?
Well, you know, the real question here is, where does President Bush at the moment stand on this problem? As we now know, there is a report that is about to come out next Wednesday that suggests that you know, this is a bipartisan commission, the Iraq Study Group. Headed by a former Republican Secretary of State, James Baker, saying that there needs to be an exit strategy. And while it is not going to go to firm timetables, it is going to suggest at least a general timetable. And I think that's going to put a whole lot of pressure on the president to sort of pick a strategy here. Is he going to go with the now much talked about surge strategy of actually bringing in more troops, or is he in fact going to have to start, you know, saying, okay, we're going to have to put a limit on this mission?
It's hard to figure out the headlines here, Karen. I mean, we've got the Times today saying that the idea of rapid withdrawal seems to fade. And then the Washington Post reporting today, Times had said something like this earlier, that the Iraq Study Group is going to say withdraw nearly all combat brigades by early 2008. Are we dancing around a timetable here? Is the big theme withdrawal or staying in?
Well, I think that the big theme here is withdrawal, but basically, you know, as you said, Tom, you know, the New York Times seems to contradict its own paper from yesterday on what this report really says. I think what they are trying to do is give the president some flexibility here.
Jack Beattie, do we see James Baker, famous as the Bush family consigliere, going up against the president? Are we going to have a nose-to-nose between these guys?
Well, the president said there's going to be no graceful exit out of Iraq, and boy, he spoke the truth there. And, of course, he was alluding in the short term to this report and to Baker's opening of a graceful exit. What I was struck with was just the unreality of the president's position, talking earlier in the week about we're going to stay on the battlefield until victory is achieved. What victory? What battlefield? And then his earlier comment that the major problem was Al-Qaeda. Is that the major problem now that we're facing civil war in Iraq? And then the Iraqi prime minister saying, oh, we'll be able to take charge of the military come June. No one thinks that's possible. And then the memo from the National Security Advisor, Hadley, that is full of unrealities, as experts said, expecting, well, let's see, if Maliki just tweaks his coalition slightly, we'll be able to get better people in there, and he can dispense with al-Sadr. He can't dispense with al-Sadr. That's his man. I mean, you just can't touch reality in the statements from these leaders and principals.
Karen, how do you read the leak very early in the week of this memo from Stephen Hadley, the one that said the Iraqi prime minister is either ignorant or misrepresenting his intentions or doesn't have the capability to turn good intentions into action? These kind of things from the National Security Advisor don't happen accidentally, one presumes. Why put this out on the eve of President Bush's trip to meet with Maliki?
Well, they not only don't happen accidentally, in this White House, they generally don't happen at all.
Right.
And, you know, there are two things that I at least saw in the decision to leak this memo. One, obviously, was to put some pressure on al-Maliki. But I also think that even if the steps that Hadley was talking about seemed, you know, insufficient, what they were trying to convey is that they at least have a real grasp of reality, that, you know, whatever the president's public statements are about, you know, al-Qaeda being mm-hmm. behind this and things, you know, that Amal Maliki being the right guy for the job, that they wanted to convey that the White House is very well aware of how bad things look there.
So trying to signal that they're on top of it at the same time that the president's saying things that give people all kinds of pause. Let's listen for just a moment to one of his statements. This was from the summit in Amman, Jordan. President Bush, he was asked what gives him confidence in Prime Minister Maliki's ability to bring security to Iraq.
He'd been selected and now he's dealing with, you know, a serious situation on the ground. And what I appreciate is his attitude. As opposed to saying, America, you go solve the problem. We have a prime minister who's saying, stop holding me back. I want to solve the problem.
The president in Amman this week. Karen Tumulty's with us from Washington. Jack Beatty's here. And we're joined right now as well in Washington by Barbara Slavin from USA Today. Barbara, thanks for being there.
Good morning.
So we're all trying to figure out what the White House is really trying to say about the Iraqi leader. Which is it? Is he, you know, raring to go to solve this problem? Is he ignorant, as Stephen Hadley's memo had it? Is he misrepresenting his intentions, a kind of code for secretly siding with the Shiite militias? Which is it?
Well, he's all we've got is the problem. He is what has been produced by this system that was elected, which, of course, the Bush administration stressed the need for democratic elections and so on.
Mm-hmm.
He is a fairly weak individual, and he's working within a very, very weak central government structure, which, again, was created by the Iraqis with the support of the United States. So, you know, it's a little bit like shooting your parents and then complaining that you're an orphan. I mean, this is the situation that we're all in. And his sympathies clearly are with the Shia majority for a variety of reasons. First of all, he is one. He was in number two, I believe, in the Dawa party, which is one of the oldest Shiite parties that fought Saddam Hussein. He owes his selection to one vote from the Muqtada al-Sadr faction, which put him over the top and gave him the job. He cannot go against the interests of the majority of the Shia parties in that country, or he will completely lose his job. And, of course, we've seen that Muqtada al-Sadr has suspended his participation in the government this week simply to protest the fact that Maliki was meeting with Bush. Some think also that Maliki did not meet Bush when he was originally intended to.
Mm-hmm.
He was a no-show at a dinner, in part to show his independence and prove that he really is a representative of the Shia in Iraq.
You're going to insult me? I'll show you my peak. I don't show for dinner.
Right, and he may want to reach out to the Sunnis, but, you know, because of this Iraq study group, everything else we're seeing, the parties in Iraq are preparing themselves for an American withdrawal, and they are preparing their factions. They are getting ready for what will likely be a very long and bloody power struggle in the coming months and years.
Lots going on there. And here, Jack Beatty, there's another leak you've been keeping an eye on this week, not just the Stephen Hadley leak, but another that looks to Hezbollah and Iran.
Yeah, this came out in the Times on Monday or Tuesday, and basically, you know, people in the White House saying that they have strong evidence that Hezbollah has been training Shiite fighters in Iraq, that Iran has been helping, that Syria has been helping, and other people quoted in the piece said, well, it doesn't look like it's that serious. What's worrisome to me is that this, of course, I think is the fuse. I mean, the more we hear about the Iran connection, the stronger the temptation is going to grow, I think, for the Bush administration, and particularly for the vice president, to make the case that we need to attack Iran. And this kind of evidence helps to bring that along. You know, we learned recently that the CIA refers to Mr. Cheney as Edgar, as in Edgar Bergen, the ventriloquist who manipulated a dummy called Charlie McCarthy. Now, is that telling us that he's still calling the shots on a possible confrontation with Iran? It's worrisome when we get this kind of leak, it seems to me, on the front page of the New York Times.
Karen Tumulty, is there even a scenario for a kind of stomp on the accelerator? Things aren't going well, so broaden the conflict. Does the U.S. have the capacity for that? And with Democrats now on the Hill, is there any way it could actually happen?
Well, I actually had a slightly different read on why they would be leaking this report at this time, and particularly since I was unable to figure out precisely what its significance was. Mm. And that was the fact that there was a lot of talk coming out of the Baker Commission about bringing Iran into the process, into diplomatic process becoming almost a partner and helping solve the problem in Iraq. And I think this was the administration's way of signaling that they do not think that the Iranians are exactly the sort of trustworthy enough to be, in fact, allies in this.
We're looking at a week in the news, from Bush and Iraq to the Pope in Turkey and more. That mystery surrounding the death of a former Russian spy is getting more complicated. On Thursday came news that former Russian Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar may also have been poisoned, and more radioactive sites found in London, including on airplanes. British Home Secretary John Reid briefed Parliament on Thursday.
To date, around 24 venues have or are being monitored, and experts have confirmed traces of contamination at around 12 of these venues.
12? That's a lot, but he tried to ease the public fears.
I would stress that the Health Protection Agency continues to reassure members of the public that the risk of exposure to this substance remains low.
Barbara Slavin, here's a weird one. What's going on? Polonium-210 and people not even trying not to leave a trail. In fact, it almost seems as though they are. 30,000, maybe, airline passengers exposed to this radioactivity. What's the hand moving here?
Well, a lot of interesting questions about the government of Vladimir Putin, which, of course, has denied any involvement. But this certainly, as many people have said, is like something out of Jean Le Carré. I was reading up a little bit on polonium, polonium-210. Yeah. Apparently, it's a substance that was created as an initiator for a nuclear reaction. It's something that gets uranium to start fissioning. And it emits neutrons at just the right energy to cause a nuclear explosion. There's some good aspects. It has a rather short half-life of 138 days, and so it's effectively gone in 3.5 years, if that's any comfort to
but
people.
But here's my question. Moscow or whoever's behind this had to know that it would be traced, and not just anybody can have it. Is this just bald, what are you going to do about it kind of global assassination going on?
Well, you know, we've seen in the past few years a tremendous regression of democratic rights and freedoms in Russia. We've seen a very self-confident Vladimir Putin, now buoyed by enormous oil reserves, basically saying, you know, we're going to chart our own policies, and almost an attempt to get back the grandeur of the old Soviet Union and the influence of the old Soviet Union. I'm just wondering whether we're also seeing some of the less savory aspects of the old Soviet Union as well.
One wonders if you can really get that back with polonium in a sushi bar or whatever this was. Karen Tumulty, bring us home. Democrats busy this week. Nancy Pelosi saying no to Alcy Hastings to be chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Wire stories coming out as we speak saying congressional aides are now pointing to Representative Sylvester Reyes of Texas to take over. How do you read Pelosi's steps this week, Karen?
Well, and to some extent, she's trying to regain the ground that she lost in her first big move as Speaker-to-be of the United States House of Representatives, which was backing her longtime ally, John Murtha, over the man who was in line for the job, her rival, Steny Hoyer mm-hmm. of Maryland, and putting a lot of people in the House's noses out of joint in doing that and being dealt a defeat. So she had a situation here where she had decided that another longtime rival, California Congresswoman Jane Harman, was not going to get the job, even though Jane Harman was the ranking Democrat on the committee. The next person in line was Alcee Hastings, who had a lot of support from the Black Caucus, but a problem on his resume in that he was impeached and convicted by the Congress for conspiring to take a $150,000 bribe. Mm. So her decision not to move him into the job did leave her with a very difficult choice then beyond that. And so she went one more step down the line and, you know, picked, if this is in fact the case, Congressman Reyes, which is going to make the Hispanic caucus happy and is also, I think, going to, you know, send a signal that she at least is sort of staying with regular order here and not, you know, imposing her own will and her own personal grievances on the management of the House.
Jack Beatty, Nancy Pelosi, and the Democrats finding their feet this week as they prepare to take the gavel in January?
Well, you know, her dispute with Harman has been written up as if it's a matter of pique. But, you know, one has to look at what Harman has done as the ranking member on that committee. She's described herself as the best Republican in the Democratic Party. When Colin Powell made his UN speech, which, of course, now we see is full of inaccuracies, to put it charitably, she said, "I happen to know that our intelligence agencies made absolutely certain that it was totally accurate." Speaking about the New York Times leak last year, she said, "I deplore that leak." This is about the NSA. "I think it's tragic that a lot of our capability is now across the pages of the newspapers." Well, of course, that's what the Bush administration was saying. So there's some substantive matter here. But what's worrisome to me is what's lost in this, and that is that the man who's going to be heading the subcommittee that controls the budget for the Justice Department looks to be Alan Mollahan of West Virginia, a Democrat, who's a sleaze ball. He's had all kinds of conflicts of interest. His income has more or less trebled over the last few years through various kinds of deals. And he's going to be controlling the budget of the FBI, which is investigating him.
Okay, so more to come on the ethics front. We'll see what the Democrats put up there. Let me go to our listeners. John's calling from Columbia, Maryland. Hi, John. What's on your mind this week?
Hi. I'm actually interested in ethics as well. During the arguments about the CO2 in front of emissions in front of the Supreme Court,
the sort of the global warming debate there this week,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not concerned. I am concerned about the particulars of the case and the outcome of the case. I'm more concerned right now about the ethics. That is that Justice Scalia made a series of comments from the bench during arguments about not being a scientist, not being interested in science, not being interested in having this case before the Supreme Court and didn't really want to be here.
Very sharp questions from him. He said right off the bat, when's the predicted cataclysm?
So, well, my problem is that he appears to have already made up his own mind prior to actually having heard the case, which means he should be recused from the case either voluntarily or forcibly, since he has obviously not
You want a blank slate on the Supreme Court justice's mind before he hears it? Karen Tumulty, is that a fair expectation here? What did you read in the Supreme Court's first day of attention to global warming here?
Well, I think, though, that what's more important here is whether he believes what he believes the federal government's role is in regulating it and mm-hmm. whether, you know, he is, you know, his own presumably his own views as to whether global warming itself is a problem should not be the determination here.
But people come to the court, Jack, with ideas. I mean, before they show up, that's not uncommon. Recuse?
Not in a case like this. I mean, if you know, the recusal and the issue about that had to do with his, you know, there was a case a year or so ago where he had been hunting with Dick Cheney, and he was a friend of Dick Cheney, and he was going to have to rule on something related to the Bush administration, and he didn't recuse himself there. So I don't think this is, you know, toward justice at a colloquy to give his opinion, that doesn't prejudice the case. Of course, we find out more and more that there's no deliberation, really, among the justices. They pretty much know what they're going to say in advance.
Karen, take this theme of inquisition, if you will, back to Congress. You've been looking at Henry Waxman there, speaking of Democrats coming up into power and the role he's likely to play in the Congress ahead. What do you see?
Well, I think that the Congress is under the Democrats is going to exercise something that it hasn't done under the Republicans with this administration, which is oversight. And, you know, the Republican Congress was very, very active. It took hundreds of hours of testimony when Bill Clinton was president on just the question of whether he had misused his Christmas card list at the White House to raise money politically. And it basically that had just entirely stopped. And what Henry Waxman is an interesting guy to watch here, because he comes in as the chairman of the Government Reform Committee, and he is the only chairman on Capitol Hill who has power, which the Republicans had granted their own chairman, Dan Burton, to issue subpoenas without consulting the committee. He can just issue them as he sees fit. And he's been a very aggressive investigator, you know, famously in 1994, hauling up all the heads of the tobacco companies in front of his committee. And I think that he's going to be a very, you know, he's very shrewd. He knows how to play these things in the media. And I think that the administration has a lot of reason to be worried now that Henry Waxman has subpoena power.
That means hearings, hearings, hearings. We heard Democrats saying, no, we don't just want to look back during the campaign. But do you think he's going to pull that trigger repeatedly?
I think he's going to pull it in some areas. For instance, he is extremely interested in the contracting for the reconstruction of Iraq and the providing of services over there by Halliburton. Mm. He is very, very interested in the way some federal agencies do their job. The FDA, I think, is one in particular. He's interested in the kind of federal contracting that happened after Hurricane Katrina. What I don't think he's probably going to end up doing is go back over the question of, you know, why did we think there were WMD? Those sorts of things, at least in interviews with me, he suggested he is not anxious to sort of replow the exact same ground that we've seen, you know, done in books and all sorts of stories.
And we'll soon see as he sits at the head of the table. Ryan is calling from Washington. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for your show. I had a question about Congress and also about, predictably, Iraq. The snub, the exchange between Senator James Webb and President Bush at the freshman's reception on the Hill a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get your thoughts on that. That strikes me as at best bad politics and rude behavior, but at worst, perhaps even though it was secondhand news, apparently from Webb's aide that he had said he'd like to slug the president. Could that be construed as a threat to the head of state?
Now, that part I didn't hear. We did see this testy exchange between James Webb, newly elected Virginia senator, and the president saying, how's your boy? Of course, James Webb's son serving in Iraq. The new senator-elect saying, worse to the effect of, I'm worried about Iraq, Mr. President. The president said, I didn't ask you that, or something like that. What about your boy? How about that? That's tough stuff from James.
Yeah, I've seen that mentioned as something his staff said or some unnamed source said, but I don't account that much. I mean, we had Mary Landrieu last year actually saying that every time she, you know, she actually said, I want to hit the president when he was talking about Katrina and the aftermath. So, but you know, that incident, people are saying it's rude in the Washington press. But my gosh, this man has a son in Iraq. The president asks him, how's your boy? And he responds, well, I'd like him home, in effect. And the president then sharply says, well, I didn't ask you that. Well, who cares what he asked him? He's got a son there. He can say what he wants. And he said, what I say to my son is between us. You know, and Jim Webb is a decorated veteran. veteran of Vietnam, and what he thinks about George Bush privately, we don't have to, you know, tax our imagination on. I don't find this. What I find is the behavior of the Washington Press Corps as if, oh, my gosh, being rude to the president. The president is not the king. He can when he says something like, I didn't ask you that, he's, you know, you don't have to give a capitulating answer.
Salute not required. Karen, Barbara, what do you say?
Well, I don't see why, you know, why he bothered to show up at a social event at the White House if, you know, his goal was to snub the president. You know, I do think that this was a situation where, you know, the president was trying to speak to him parent to parent. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the need to not make everything so partisan. And, you know, again, this was a social event that Senator-elect Webb did not have to go to.
That's true. But if you put yourself in his shoes, I mean, President Bush's two daughters were celebrating their 25th birthdays in Argentina, while James Webb's son is somewhere in Iraq. So I think I can put myself in Webb's shoes also.
I wonder if, given what we're seeing in Iraq, how much trouble there is there, at what's being described as just how grim the future may be there, if we may not see more of this, you know, dropping the political niceties and real anger at the fore. Karen, do you see it infecting the politics coming up?
I do, but I hope that if this is the case, it is played out where it should be, which is on the floor of the House and the Senate, in very sharp exchanges in hearings, and, you know, even as the president travels the country. You know, I just think that there is the, you know, an event that was just strictly arranged as a photo op, essentially.
Mm. But tough to contain the kind of concern we see coming now. Tom's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I appreciate the opportunity. I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion and different things being discussed. You know, what's on my mind, certainly, and obviously I think is Iraq, only because I felt it personally as far as being over there.
You've served, Tom.
That's correct. It's been on two occasions now, the most recent returning in April of this year. And, you know, the world seems as though, I guess, it's burning. If you want to put a word on it, the biggest thing, honestly, though, that I get and take away from Iraq is the fact that there's a disconnection between the American people and, well, not just the American people, but the world and what's actually happening there. It's really, honestly, it's a religious war at day's end.
So should we be hanging in, or should we be talking about withdrawal? You see both themes in the headlines this week, Tom.
No, hanging in. I mean, without question. I mean, I know everyone, at least with respect to the American military, volunteered today, but it's a matter of hanging in there. And I know that a lot of people have been, you know, disapproving of the president's labeling of it as far as staying the course. But honestly, there's so much riding on this, it's unbelievable.
But can we solve a religious war? You've been there, and that's how you describe it. You know, Americans hear that and think, oh, my gosh, how do we settle that?
Well, I think we can solve it if we approach it from that perspective. The problem is that, you know, we tend to too much, and there's a whole historical background, but we tend to approach it too much from the secular and sectarian side of things and just say, even today it's being coined, it's a sectarian event, and it isn't. It's much more than that. It's beyond that at this particular point.
Some days it seems beyond any descriptor we can come up with. Civil war, sectarian, religious, they're all in there. Tom, thanks for your call. A couple of great correspondents with us. Barbara Slavin, senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, is here. Jack Beatty's here as well. And Sebastian's calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, Sebastian. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling about the Baker Report. And it seems to me that their recommendations are so vague and unhelpful that I read it, you know, what we've seen in the papers about it, that they're basically throwing up their hands and saying, well, there's nothing to be done. It seems to me like this is the diplomatic equivalent of taking your car to the garage, and the mechanic says, well, do you know any good taxi services?
and just when we were all dying for a firm foothold of a concept or a strategy here.
Yeah. You know, talk to the neighbors. It's so bland that it just doesn't seem to be much of a response at all.
Well, we'll see for sure next week. But, Barbara, first to you on this. I mean, there is this sense we've been floating, waiting for something firm. Now here comes this. It sounds pretty general coming in. How long can we just float like this? The price of Iraq, the consequences of Iraq are mounting, are real. Here we are. We'll be in the presidential campaign soon. Can we just free float along on this, or do we have to have some kind of new firm policy?
In all fairness to the people who've worked very hard on this report, none of us have read the entire report. It's something like 100 pages long.
Absolutely.
From people that I've spoken to this week, it is, frankly, much broader than just dealing with this issue of troops. Obviously, that's very important for Americans. But it's going to call for a really broad new approach to the Middle East. It's basically asking the Bush administration to take a page from President Bush's father to try to revive Arab-Israeli talks on all fronts. That's the Palestinians and the Israelis, the Syrians and the Israelis, to bring together, you know, all of the neighbors and Israel, perhaps, in something that might look like the Madrid Conference of 1991. It sees Iraq in the context of its region. It sees a dysfunctional region where every conflict is related to every other conflict, and that means Lebanon and Palestine as well as Iraq. So I think a lot of thought has gone into this report, and we should see it as a whole, you know, the troop aspects obviously being important, but also the diplomatic aspects. And then the question is whether this administration has the will to actually try to implement some of these recommendations. You've spoken of their distrust of the Syrians, their distrust of the Iranians. It is true that Syria and Iran have played a nefarious role in Iraq, but if you do not engage them in some way, they will continue to play that role.
Karen Tumulty, what about it here? Madrid conference and Israel and Palestinians talking again, that sounds very much like Jim Baker and his time with Bush 1 in the White House. Does that still sound like the kind of policy that may cut it here? We don't want to prejudge this report. It'll be out next week. We'll all see it. But we're looking at instincts and history here.
Well, and politically, in terms of, you know, what I think the American people are looking for, what politicians are looking for, this sounds like just another process. You know, we've been originally, you know, the problems were going to be solved if they could get a constitution. Then the problems were going to be solved if they could hold an election or form a government. And so at least to, you know, this may be a game-changing idea, but it just sounds like yet another process that people are being asked to put their faith into. And, you know, in the meantime, in the time that this study group has been working, the acronym that gets used about it a lot in Washington is OBE, overtaken by events. Mm. So much has happened. The situation there is so much worse that it is, you know, I think that this would have sounded a lot fresher, a lot bigger, a lot more revolutionary if it had been broached, say, last spring.
But spreading problems and the idea of a regional look sounds important. Let's go to Kathleen in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because a few days before the supposed summit in Jordan, King Abdullah had said that there was a danger of three civil wars going on simultaneously in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And in the light of that,
he was looking at Iraq and the Palestinians, Israelis, and Lebanon.
And in light of that, I wondered what you and your guests had to say about the huge rally that's going on now, organized by Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah in Beirut to bring down the Lebanese government.
Barbara, this is back in your turf. King Abdullah looking around and feeling a lot too much shaking in his neck of the woods. In Lebanon, the government hanging by a thread.
Yeah, absolutely. This is definitely one to watch. Like, this is Hezbollah's power play. They are looking to bring down this government, the Senora government, which is sort of the last vestige of Condi Rice's quote-unquote new Middle East. The government has already lost its Hezbollah ministers. One of its ministers, a Christian, was assassinated the other week. And I think if one more minister goes, then the cabinet has to fall. And this is a massive show of popular support for Hezbollah. And here again, we see a certain strategy. Iran and Syria are the backers of Hezbollah. Iran is the backer of most of the Shia militias in Iraq. Iran and Syria have been providing support to militant Palestinian groups that don't want to recognize Israel. They're feeling on the ascendancy. And, you know, in this situation, it is very difficult, really, without some major paradigm shift that looks at all of these these conflicts and that looks at the grievances of both Syria and Iran with the United States, it's difficult to see how we get out of Iraq in one piece.
Jack Beatty, talk about OBE overtaken by events. Can James Baker say, let's talk to Syria and Iran when, let's say, they're taking down the Lebanese government, in effect, and, you know, rearranging the whole chessboard?
Well, that may be the example of being overtaken by events. That who could have predicted that just a few months ago? Although I suppose it was implicit in the triumph that Hezbollah seemed to record after the Israeli incursion. You know, it's almost as if there are two roads here. One road is the Baker Road. Let's take it big. Let's go to let's see the Iraq matter within the region, within all of these internecine and even international conflicts. And then the other road to take it big is the one that Cy Hirsch talks about in last week's New Yorker. He's got, and I mentioned earlier, and that's the, you know, confrontation with Iran.
Take
it
big
that way. Big war. And he quotes people as saying, you know, I don't know who his sources are. They're not identified, but as saying that, you know, Bush and Cheney, or Cheney particularly, think that the answer to Iraq is just to kind of, you know, treble the catastrophe and attack Iran and sort of re-scramble things that way, and that they're using subversion in Iran. I don't know how much of that is true, but I do think that may be a point of, that we may be at that fork in the road.
Looking for a game, maybe, that they think they can win in that direction. Don's calling from Washington. Hi, Don, you're on the air.
Hi, what a week, huh?
Yeah.
My question is this. Hasn't George Bush and the Bush administration become the most inconsequential administration in the eyes of the world, in the sense that with the leaked memo, with the firing of Rumsfeld, and all the posturing that's going on, that we are definitely going to get out of Iraq relatively soon, and everything else is really just some type of elaborate dance that is the setup for our withdrawal? And I would like to hear your panel's thoughts on this idea of the inconsequentiality of the Bush administration. And, Jack, thank you for your clarity of thought.
Don, thanks for your call. Well, I mean, here it is. Maybe this is another fork, but Karen, I'll come first to you. Inconsequential as a word to be attached to George Bush. He's a lame duck president. He's got 2 years left. He's not running for re-election. And yet, he's got all kinds of powers, commander-in-chief. He certainly hasn't been inconsequential so far. All kinds of consequences out there. How do you imagine his inner circle surveying this next 2 years of problems they're looking at? Stay, go? Do you agree with Don that withdrawal is inevitable?
I don't at all. I don't know what is going to happen, but there are any number of options here available to the president. And if anything, I think that the issuing of the Baker report and a lot of the other stuff has essentially, you know, put the ball in the president's court. It's his move here. I don't know if he's going to, you know, move toward withdrawal or move toward more troops, maybe, you know, taking out al-Sadr. I don't know.
Barbara?
Well, I think he is going to maintain U.S. troops and a U.S. presence in Iraq, certainly through his presidency, assuming the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people do not rise up and reject the American presence totally, which is always something one can consider. This notion of attacking Iran is one of the things that I think would lead all the Shia in Iraq to rise up and reject the American presence, given that many of them are affiliated with Iran, get support from Iran. So I think I don't see how we attack Iran without having had a substantial withdrawal from Iraq first, at least, just to protect American forces there. But my guess, and this is just my guess from watching this administration, is that they will try to take some of the combat forces out. They will try this idea of building up trainers, taking a back seat to the Iraqis, redeploying maybe some of the troops to Kuwait, Bahrain, other places in the region, and just see whether they can do it without the country coming apart even more at the seams. But I don't see George Bush as someone who's going to withdraw, no matter what anyone says, as long as he thinks there's a possibility of holding together some sort of government and of justifying this whole invasion to begin with.
And there's a kind of having it both ways quality to what we've heard so far of the Baker report. That is, yes, withdraw combat troops, but other troops there potentially for a very long time. Let's get another call from Mike in Washington. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Morning, Tom.
Hey.
I think there's too much, seriously too much civility in the decorum of public debate in Washington. The problem is you can lie about yellowcake uranium and about aluminum tubes and about mushroom clouds and then stand back and know that no one's going to call you a liar. When Barbara Boxer called Condoleezza Rice on the carpet on Capitol Hill at those hearings about a year and a half ago, she essentially all but called her a liar, and the press and everyone went crazy on Barbara Boxer for being so uncivil.
So you say not too little civility, but too much.
Way too much civility, because the fact of the matter is you need to be able to call a liar, and then spell out what those lies are. The problem is nobody's willing to do that because they're afraid of a backlash, because the decorum of public debate is more important than honesty in government. And that's a problem.
Well, maybe all that will get tested with the Democrats. Jack, what do you think about the general tenor in Washington? We've had this decorum conversation running through our talk today. And Mike says, forget it. Let's just lay it out there.
I'm all with him. I mean, I think plain talk is always at a discount. And look, this is a catastrophe, what's happened in Iraq. Whether you see it as something we were deceived into or just a kind of blind man's, stumble into it, whatever it is, it's a catastrophe. And not to speak plainly about it and about the people responsible just seems to me to be a moral evasion. So, yeah, I think people should be called what they are, and if you could substantiate it, say it. I really think there's been too much of this. If civility means let's not even be intellectually honest, no, we don't need that kind of civility.
Let's go to Joe in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Joe. I wonder why, and to get opinion of your guests, why there seems to be so little discussion of probably the most essential ingredient in being successful in creating social or political change in a country, and that is the political will of the so-called government that we have attempted to establish that would presumably address itself to American goals.
So are you talking about the Iraqi government and whose political will, Iraqis or American?
The political and social will of Iraqis themselves to contribute their efforts toward the kind of political structure that the U.S. is attempting to see come to pass in Iraq. Give you an example. We all know that we had our heads handed to us in Vietnam simply because the South Vietnamese government has very little political will to address itself through the loss of treasure and lives to oppose Ho Chi Minh in the North. What it appears to me now is that there's so little discussion in the press and otherwise about that being probably the fundamental reason why we aren't making any progress, that the Iraqis simply are not signing on to the goals and the methods that the United States is trying to promote. One interesting sidelight on that, and I'll finish, and that is that we seem to be going on forever talking about training up Iraqi troops. Well, the U.S. probably is the best trainer of military troops in the world. We have rigid schedules.
And it's not happening. Our time is short. Joe, let me put it to Barbara Slavin. The question of Iraqi will in the midst of all this. I mean, they seem so busy dodging bombs and bullets, it's hard to know what the Iraqi will is at this point, or if it's so fragmented that the Iraqi will itself is a recipe for civil war.
Let's go back to the flawed concept. You know, the administration first went into Iraq talking about WMD, didn't find WMD, so then Iraq had to become this showcase for democracy, and there had to be elections, elections, elections. You do not force people who have never had free elections in their lives to have elections and expect good results. What happened, because of the short time frame, was that everybody coalesced basically around religious leaders. And so you had an increase in the political fractioning of the country on religious lines, and that's the sort of government that was formed. The big mistake was to push for elections so soon. Frankly, I think if the U.S. had it to do all over again, they should have established a government that they supported, perhaps a government in exile, bring in some of the locals, establish it, let it function, let it work, and talk about elections sometime down the road. It was the insistence on having an elected government that is responsible to a great extent for what we're seeing today.
Karen, you're our domestic political guru here. Do you see the export democracy drive surviving past the Bush administration? Is Iraq going to be the big, you've got to be kidding, example on that front?
Yeah, I mean, the fact is, you really don't hear
even people talking about that much anymore. I mean, it seems like if at this point, if we could get stability there, we'd call it a win.
And Jack, is what the administration didn't want to begin with. They said stability was stagnation and produced al-Qaeda.
The Pope in Turkey, sort of, we've just got a few seconds here, but raising his arms, even turning toward Mecca this week, one wonders if there's some kind of conceptual breakthrough there. He's been a stern critic of Islam, but we've got to look somewhere.
Yes, and he also talked about religious freedom in Turkey, referring to Orthodox Christians and their limited expression. That's a welcome development. Although I think he was really given a bum rap for that attack on him when he was citing a historic document talking about the Muslim religion
in
the past.
Way back then. Well, he's made his try this week. While our eyes opened in another week, a little bit singed once again, but we're trying to learn. We're learning. Barbara Slavin with USA Today, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Karen Tumulty with Time Magazine. Karen, great to have you.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Jack, thanks for being here this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.